This edition of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 7th of October 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly, episode 170, with me, Robert Bounds, and Andrew Tuck.
On today's show, we'll be learning one of the ways to turn print back to profit with Justin B. Smith, the man who helped turn the fortunes of The Atlantic magazine.
We'll also be meeting Michael Mayer, the mind behind one of Cologne's most refined musical exports, ambient minimal music label Compact Records.
And we'll get a look ahead to next week's London Film Festival with festival director Claire Stewart.
All that, plus we'll get next week's big stories and play nice tunes too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Turn the heat up in here, Andrew. Can you tell?
Yes, because the glass is actually misting up as we speak.
That's because we're having such a good time in here on the radio, isn't it?
We've got a mystery guest sitting in the corner as well. Maybe he's bringing the heat in, I think. Anyway.
Mystery guest?
Yes. Well, he's not much of a mystery. Not to you and me, but...
He's sort of making a very coquettish face. We could bring him in here now. He could be part of the top of the show. What do you think? Should we break the habit of 170 episodes? Hi, Tom Edwards.
Hello, both. How are you?
We're all right. What do you think? Are you feeling better? I notice you're doing your customary thing of wearing a T-shirt underneath your shirt.
Always.
Don't you like? Is this because you don't like washing or something?
No, always wear a vest because you never know.
You never know. You never know what.
The 1930s call, they want their dress sense back.
That was
you
one of those
know.
Kind of open-ended pieces of advice.
I like that, yeah.
I got from an elderly relative when I was a young man.
Yeah. Yeah. Normally we pause a bit before you because we come to you for the kind of wrap-up of what lies ahead for the week. But we should just touch on the last 2 weeks. You've had a kind of what's been called a holiday and you've been calling work.
Exactly.
Where have you been?
I've been visiting Monocle's bureau in Hong Kong, Tokyo, and New York City in the US. And all in the space of about a fortnight. What excitement. Great to catch up with all my illustrious colleagues in those locations. Visit the offices, which I had not previously had the pleasure. Very nicely appointed they are too. But now I'm back in London. The heartbeat, if you like, of the operation.
Now, people were very suspicious when you came back because you've got lots of new clothes and a new haircut.
It's completely untrue, but and of course our trusted listeners will have
and
no
why,
way.
And why are you wearing makeup and stuff?
I've changed a lot of my travels.
Hi, Tom Edwards. What was your best bit? Which is the best bureau? If you had to choose one of the roll top desks, which one would it be?
I couldn't possibly choose one, could I, Rob? I mean,
you could.
We're not talking people. We're talking actual office space. Where would you?
I liked the New York.
Try that girl in Hong Kong. The other one.
What?
See.
The New York bureau is nice, isn't it? Because our bureau in New York is kind of it's on the corner of Houston and Broadway, and it's in a kind of older, kind of creakier building, the Midori House.
Yeah, the cable building, I think, is it called?
Yeah, that's where the cable cars used to come in, isn't it?
That's right, and it's got a lot of the sort of period features. It has a real nice charm, period charm to it, which I found very agreeable.
You said it hasn't got those period features anymore. I think we've got rid of the older members of staff.
So this is when you were wandering around looking at the architectural details. Oh, you were busy.
Absolutely.
You were so busy. Man,
that's busy. Alive. That's about an aesthetic appreciation.
Anyway, it's time to, what it's time to do? It's time to polish your crystal balls. Go on, off you go. What lies ahead in the week in news?
Well, I think one thing that we should look out for today, of course, is that it's Vladimir Putin's 60th birthday. Were you aware of that?
Happy birthday,
Vladimir. Because I normally get someone else on the culture desk to send my birthday cards out. I just sign them. Sometimes I don't even know who they're for.
Well, do you know what you could sign, Rob? Events taking place today. There's a giant banner across the Don River. That's one. But there's a giant postcard being signed by locals in Chelyabinsk and being sent to the Kremlin. A giant postcard. So you could have just travelled over.
Just all the people
up
that love Vladimir Putin in Russia.
Exactly.
Why do they need a giant one?
Oh, now come on. He's such a popular guy. He wins every election.
He's very tough. He's looking very good for his age. Will there be any more of these sort of pictures that we amuse ourselves sometimes
in the
Western
wrestling
media?
Wrestling a bear,
manhandling a Kalashnikov.
I think he might be a little more dignified, given that he's 60 up.
Yeah.
I think he might sort of...
Do you know what Rob's favourite trick is when signing a card? Is to get the event wrong deliberately. So he often, when someone's leaving, he always puts happy birthday.
That's a nice touch.
And when it's someone's birthday, he puts, "You'll be missed."
It's I don't know. Is it still funny? I don't know.
It's still quite funny.
You got a birthday coming up soon, Tom?
Not for a while.
Oh,
so
damn.
I'll be safe.
All right. Well, we'll do it on your leaving then. That might come sooner.
That could be.
Happy birthday!
That could be imminent. I get that feeling.
Anyway.
Okay. Happy birthday, Vladimir.
So, and Vladimir Putin, 60. Good. When's that?
That's today.
That's today, okay.
So cool. Everyone can, you know, send him their best
wishes.
We'll
see if by the end of the show we can't find some happy birthday music for Vlad.
Exactly, that would be pleasant.
And next?
Well, I like to look at the, you know, the worlds of banking and high finance on this show, because that's the kind of moment we're looking for. On Tuesday, it's the annual meeting of the World Bank Group and the IMF in Tokyo. Now, obviously, perhaps ordinarily a little bit of a dry topic, but I think given the problems that we're seeing all around the world, this could be a really
all the attendees at that meeting took the precaution to wear a vest, an economic vest, Tom, then you should dish out some advice there.
That's good. You see, the
should have left a few vests in the office in Tokyo to hand out to this IMF.
The metaphorical
group.
Economic string vest will have
string vest. I can see it. I mean, it's not that bad. It's not Ramsey Nesbitt.
That will have, you know, got people out of a lot of bother. But let's see, they got their work cut out. But it'll be interesting to watch. So that's in Tokyo on Tuesday.
Do you understand the science behind a string vest? Why did they ever become popular?
I think because it's to do with trapping air, isn't it? It's kind of like a precursor to what we have with thermal stuff now, thermal underwear now. I think it's all about trapping air.
Yeah,
it's like wearing layers is better than wearing one big huge woolly jumper.
It lets the skin breathe, but retains some heat.
Yeah.
Oh, gosh. You really have discovered the world of vests, haven't you?
I've always been a fan.
Vest Monthly, that was that magazine I saw on your desk.
Oh, God, my seat, another one of my secrets is
guest
out.
Editor, he's our vest editor. He's
Tom
Edwards.
Stop it.
What's thing three? Come on. Three's a trend.
This is the final one. This is a bit of fun. So I know you guys are both familiar with the life and times of Felix Baumgartner.
Yeah.
No?
What did Felix do? Felix?
Felix? I think it's like he's Austrian, so it comes with a bit of... Is that wrong?
No, that sounds good.
Do the whole sort of accent.
He's a not...
Felix Baumgartner.
Oh, that was pretty good. That's like he joined us himself. But he's busy at the moment because tomorrow, the Austrian extreme athlete is going to set a new record. He wants to be the first human to break the sound barrier at 1,110 kilometres per hour. In free fall.
Can
you believe that?
You were going to punch that silence yourself.
What did you have to jump out of?
He's out of like an actual space capsule.
Right.
At 36,500 metres.
Yeah.
So that's about three times higher than a jet liner would fly.
It's almost 4 miles high.
Yeah. So 1% oxygen at that height. He plummets through space. Then he will... take his weird freefall winged shape.
Never has a man needed a vest more.
Well, imagine he's probably got three or four vests on.
Then you need the pants as well to go with it, actually.
Well, can you imagine? And also, it's being broadcast live from cameras attached to him. Apparently, it's quite a risky enterprise.
Is it going on the YouTube?
It'll be all over the internet.
I hope it works.
Do you know why you said it like
that?
Well,
it says here there's a few risks, so I'll just quickly run through them.
Yeah, okay. So run through risks.
His lungs could overinflate and burst.
Okay.
The vessels in his brain could explode. His blood could boil and his eyes could hemorrhage. And he could just break his neck.
That sounds about like me about 5 o'clock most days.
The likelihood is that he's going to crap himself. That's the most likely thing, isn't it?
He strikes me, Felix Baumgartner, as a man who doesn't... He just doesn't understand fear.
He regards fear with a haughty stare, but you can't really give that haughty stare with those hemorrhaged eyeballs, can he?
Where does he rent the spaceship to jump out of?
I believe it's he has some kind of sponsorship. I don't know.
We need more information. Well, let's next week get you back and we'll find out whether
how Felix got on.
Shall we? Yeah. Can we just quickly queue up Free Falling by Tom Petty or Rocket Man by Elton John? No, they're shaking their heads. Damn. All right. Well, thank you very much, Tom, for the news review. That was good, wasn't it, Andrew?
It was a pleasure, as always.
Yes, welcome back from your travels. We've had Steve Bloom for the last couple of weeks. Good.
It's
not quite the same.
Stay tuned, because coming up next, we'll be talking to Justin B. Smith, president of the Atlantic Media Company.
Justin, thanks for joining us. So first of all, for the few people who don't know the story of the Atlantic, can you just tell us exactly who the Atlantic is and its very recent history, which you've been involved in, which is a very interesting history because you've taken a print brand that I think, like many print brands, had a few question marks next to it, and you've kind of given it a bit of a rosy future.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Delighted to be on your show. Well, The Atlantic, for those of you who don't know, is actually America's oldest continuously published magazine. I know there's a lot of qualifiers there, but it was founded in 1857.
It came out in 1984.
Founded in 1857 by really some of the greatest thinkers, literary thinkers in American history, Ralph Waldo Emerson and Thoreau and a number of the great writers up in Boston, which was the intellectual capital of America at the time. It played a huge role in American history. It endorsed Abraham Lincoln, and the stories go on and on. And sadly, into the 20th century, it got eclipsed by some more commercial, larger brands, such as the Vanity Fairs of this world and maybe even the New Yorker. And by the 1990s and the turn of the 21st century, it was a very influential and very great, had a wonderful reputation, very high quality content, but it actually was losing tons and tons of money, about the rate of about $10 million a year. And so it was owned by a sort of a philanthropist come publisher who at one point, he tells a funny story, he turned to his wife and said, "This is the worst philanthropy in the world because I'm supporting rich white people." because it's a very high end magazine. And, anyway, I happened to be a publishing entrepreneur, and he found me. I brought The Week magazine with Felix Dennis to the U.S. That was my venture before this, and then worked at The Economist before. And he brought me on to sort of help turn it around. And what we did, and the dirty little secret is, The Atlantic didn't really have a very strong, it was losing $10 million a year, so we didn't have much to protect in terms of a legacy print business. And so we were able just to look out at the landscape in the future and really answer the question, where is dramatic, exciting growth? And in America, at least, the digital space is really where that is. And so we proceeded across 5 years to take a magazine that was sort of 400,000 paid subscribers and build around it a massive digital property and digital audience that is now almost 20 million unique users a month.
And you're doing that, and you're putting your, I guess that's the difference between circulation and readership. You're basically advertising to a readership, to all those other people that can access it for free.
We adopted a free model. I mean, there's obviously this huge debate between paid and free. We decided that The Atlantic, if by going free and by producing basic Atlantic style content, but at digital speed and digital metabolism. Effectively, we sort of took a monthly magazine that wrote a lot of long-form content and turned it on the web into a daily or even minute-by-minute newspaper of sorts. I mean, we publish 120 original stories a day on theatlantic.com, and 4 years ago, we published maybe two or three.
The digital metabolism needs some heartburn pills sometimes.
It does, yes.
And I was just going to say, when you've got that 20 million there, and the core of it 400,000, although that seems a smaller number, you certainly don't want to lose those people as you grow and you develop. Have their interests and aspirations actually stayed at the heart of the whole operation?
Well, I think the key is to identify kind of a brand sort of, and sorry to use the cliche, sort of DNA of sorts or sensibility of sorts, and to make sure that that core thing that makes The Atlantic valuable in the print format is also expressed in a similar way, and that thread runs through the digital expression. And what was really easy for us is that The Atlantic's core brand DNA was always as a vessel for voices. It was a place really where writers, great writers, would make big arguments. So fast forward to 2008 when we began this venture. What is blogging? Blogging is sort of, the internet is a vessel for big arguments, big voices. So we really were able to sort of transport that core mission into the digital realm and without really sacrificing any sense of our purpose.
And did you ever pick up, because I think there were people like Andrew Sullivan, who was obviously a notable blogger and rode your sexy surfboard for quite a long time?
Or we rode his sexy surfboard, I'm not sure.
I don't know what's going on.
Depends if you ask Andrew. I think Andrew might have a different view, yeah.
And how does that work? Was it strange then putting bloggers into print as well? I mean, I guess both things come with a turf, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, our early strategies back in 2008-2007 was to jumpstart the digital audience by effectively hiring these great voices with existing followings of their own. We sort of moved on from that. It's a bit like renting renting a building or something. You never own it, and you can always get kicked out. So we shifted to sort of growing our own sort of talent and our own writers and building out a big stable of them. So, but I think that the journalistic quality and the intelligence is something that we really haven't sacrificed despite the web metabolism.
And I wanted to ask you about the web metabolism. It's obviously different, very different to the print one. One of the things I think you did was sort of break down the walls between advertising and editorial, which is a very brave thing to do. And a lot of magazines, a lot of media companies do that. A lot of people would quite like to know what's going on, you know, a floor up or over the next desk, right? Did that sort of change the sort of things that you published, things that you realised people wanted because advertisers were keen to stick their branding onto something? Did that change the way you thought quite largely?
Yeah, I mean, I would put Monocle as more of a market leader than us in this particular domain, but...
Flatter us.
Well, depending on who you ask, right? It's either a flatterer or a critic. No, I mean, I think that we often say that, you know, we'd like to have a meeting between editors and ad salespeople and let the editors come up with ad ideas and the ad people come up with edit ideas. The thing is that there's sort of a quadrant. There's sort of things that are reader wins and reader kind of negatives, and there are things that are sort of that are advertiser wins and audience negatives. And what we, in this collaborative process, by kind of melding church and state, you will, we're always looking for the things that work for readers and also work for advertisers. And it's okay to actually admit that that's the pool of that you want to fish in.
We were talking sort of about models, about media models. Is that something you've got much interest in, or does it really always kind of happen by accident and the cards you've got in your hands?
Oh, no. I mean, I think the media business models is sort of the name of the game these days. Either you have a strong view and you kind of collect data amongst all these shifting sands and make intelligent decisions, or you're toast. So I'm definitely a student of digital media business models, generally speaking, and it's a dicey business, I'll tell you that.
I wanted to ask you, obviously, one of the reasons you're here is because of those shifting sands. You're moving the Atlantic into kind of other areas, and one of the things you've just launched is Quartz, which is a portal for kind of for news about business. Now, I guess in the old days, the Atlantic was seen as kind of commenting a little bit of, you know, afar from the world of business, and probably not quite sure of what it always made of it. But this is kind of getting into the world of business and delivering content on a set kind of range of subjects that you've kind of chosen that these are your anchor subjects. Could you just tell us a little bit about what Quartz is and why you decided it was the time to move in this direction?
Well, I mean, I think it starts with the digital transformation of the Atlantic. So the Atlantic, I mean, the punchline that I didn't get to at the end of it, but when you first asked me, is that we actually doubled the size of the company. We took the losses from $10 million to profits of almost $3 or $4 million across 3 or 4 years, which are really, really terrible years. The reason I say that is it's that once we realized we were able to really do the digital transformation thing extremely well, we immediately thought, well, let's now take this show on the road and let's go, rather than actually transform ourselves, let's go disrupt other marketplaces that are kind of ripe for digital disruption. And so we looked at, we saw the global business and finance market as a really, really interesting space. It was, you know, it's dominated by a couple of players like The Economist and the FT, and you know, maybe a little bit The Wall Street Journal. And it's fueled by very high quality journalism. It has a lot of the same advertising base as The Atlantic does. But most importantly, I think after the crash of 08 and 09, this global financial crash, you know, the speed or the acceleration of globalization has really become noticeable. And even you sense it now in the U.S., that the U.S. is sort of retreating from its position of world dominance, and obviously Europe as well. So we felt that it was an opportune time to kind of create a new brand for the global professional class who every day were navigating the global economy and the global business landscape. And that, in particular, when you look at this group of people, it's an exploding group of people. It's large, it's big. There are many, many more people every single day joining this class. But they're also some of the earliest and most aggressive adopters of digital media, particularly tablet media and smartphone media. And so Quartz is a brand that's designed to serve them in a very utilitarian way with insight and news and information and analysis about how to win in the global economy, but done in a native mobile digital environment and a native mobile digital sort of speed and rhythm.
He's going to say metabolism again.
Nope.
And just tell me, when you're reporting for this global audience, I know that at Monocle, we think that people, when people crack open the spine, they'll guess that we're kind of a European magazine. We don't want to be particularly a London magazine. The writers we have are from all over the world. We want to feel international without feeling bland. Is that the same for you when you're trying to make a website that's you're sitting in the States as your HQ? Do you think when people look at it, they think this is an American perspective on world business? Or do you want it to be actually something, if I'm sitting here in London or in Sydney, I log on, I think, actually, this is talking to me?
Well, I mean, our goal is the latter, that it actually that people see it as a brand and content that is global in its outlook and not tied to a specific continent or culture. Now, whether we've succeeded or not, you have to ask the person in Beijing and Sydney. I think it's a process. It's a road. We have chosen, I think, much like Monocle, an editorial staff that is extremely international. From, I think they speak 119, or they've reported from 119 different countries in aggregate, the reporters, and they speak dozens and dozens of languages. We've got freelancers around the world, much like you guys do as well. So while we are HQ'd in New York City, technology and these new modes of freelancing and kind of and editorial models allow you to really cover the world much more globally than in the past.
And that was Justin B. Smith, president of the Atlantic Media Company. And you're listening to the Monocle Weekly. We'll be back after this.
For the latest Monocle news, previews on upcoming films, glimpses of the new issue, and the inside scoop of all of our retail ventures and new products, you need to do one simple thing. Subscribe to the free Monocle Bulletin. Sign up now at monocle.com.
For decades, Detroit has been a poster child for the misfiring American dream. But amid block after block of post-industrial decline, there are signs that Motor City is jump-starting its economy, as Monocle Films discovers.
The phrase triple bottom line echoes around the city among small business operators. There is a dual desire, a sense of pride even, to make a success not only for themselves, but also for Detroit.
Retooling Motor City, in the programs menu on monocle.com.
Welcome back to the Monocle Weekly with me, Andrew Tuck, and Robert Bound.
Compact Records is the Cologne-based electronic music label that takes a more subdued approach to Germany's rich dance music heritage. Growing from a record store of the same name since 1998, label boss Michael Mayer has steered the ship over the calm seas of minimal and ambient music.
Rob sat down earlier with Mayer to find out more.
Michael, thanks for joining us on the Weekly.
You're welcome.
I wanted to ask you first. Lots of people, there's a lot of talk about scenes and this and that and all sorts of, in all sorts of music kind of genres. But the Cologne electronic dance music scene is something that you might have to explain. I'm slightly arching my eyebrows here for some of our listeners, because this is a massive thing. Cologne is a massive city for electronic dance music in the 80s and 90s.
It kind of started in the early 90s. There were suddenly like a lot of artists that pursued like, let's say, different ways of creating electronic dance music.
Yeah.
Music that didn't sound like the sound that was already there from cities like Chicago or Detroit, London, New York. Cologne, pretty quickly developed an own language of dance music, like a more stripped down sound, a sound that became well known as minimal techno. but apart from that, there's also artists like Mouse and Mars or the guys from A Music, which are more into the very experimental side of electronic music. And Compact. Compact is a label and distribution center for mainly dance music, but also other kinds of electronic music. We got kind of well known for crossbreeding minimal techno dance music with other genres. There's a very strong pop influence in our music.
And I wanted to ask you that Compact became sort of a bit synonymous in the 90s and still now, obviously, with Cologne and with that sort of music. What's the importance of a label on a scene when there's one very strong label with the producers and DJs and remixers and a lot of brains and brawn and musicality poured into that one sort of organisation? It's kind of the history of Compact and the history of the city or the city's music heritage are quite interwoven, aren't they?
I mean, Cologne has a very long-standing tradition in electronic music. Karlheinz Stockhausen is from Cologne. There's the band Can, the whole crowd rock movement started in Düsseldorf and Cologne. But I wouldn't say that there's a direct line between what those guys did and what we do. There's a certain respect, of course, but we weren't influenced.
Is it quite tribal? That's why, because I guess when you're slightly different, but it's in a very specific genre, you can be considered an infidel, or a brother. You know, I want to know how the lines are sort of drawn within the sort of specificity of these genres of music.
Well, in the early 90s, when we were probably at our most experimental stage, the common reception of Compact was like, okay, these guys are the mad scientists.
Right.
You can't dance to this kind of music, which always like insulted us because we like to party.
All hot and sweaty from dancing to it yourself.
That is interesting. Like you let's, if you compare it to politics, there's a leading party and there's the opposition. Mm-hmm. We're in the opposition.
It's quite a nice place to be. Though.
Yeah, which allows you like to move much more freely. You just suggest alternatives or improvements, and you see if those are accepted by the people.
Yeah, but and on the label front with Compact, like labels of any, whether it's classical music, whether it's indie music, whether it's electronic music, a very sort of strong brand associated with a label, and you know what you're going to get within a certain sort of genre with a certain label. That's a very important thing, isn't it? I mean, that must have been something important to you growing up, buying records, saving up to buy records. It must have been a badge of honor to have records from certain labels for you growing up and starting mixing stuff, right?
I mean, I grew up buying vinyl.
Yeah.
And I blindly follow with certain labels in the early 90s, like New Groove from New York. Mm-hmm. I would just like buy every record without listening to it. And the great thing about New Groove at the time was that New Groove was completely unpredictable. You never knew what you get, except the little logo on the record. They released like a dancehall record in 1 week, and the next week it would be a techno record, and then something more disco-related, deep house. Like lots of the now famous New York producers started there, and so New Groove could be seen as a blueprint for what we do at Compact. It was always important for us that any kind of music we like would have a place in our label. We follow a very undogmatic approach. The only thing that is relevant is if we like it or not. Like it's the personal taste is the only criterion. All the rest is
That's a nice business plan, or maybe it's an anti-business
plan. It's an anti-business plan, exactly. Yeah.
But it's a nice place to be. It's nice to be able to curate what comes out there, and it either gets a thumbs up or a thumbs down on your sort of jukebox jury at the label, which is a kind of very cool place to be. And presumably the kind of thing you can only do if you're an indie label, if you're small, and if you're sort of passionate. Are those sort of three of the big sort of ticks in the box that you've sort of been able to kind of award yourself over the years of doing Compact? And I wanted to ask you about the actual scene itself, going out and listening to this stuff, seeing DJs. Is that something that you are still sort of voraciously excited about? You're still traveling a lot, doing, you know, playing sets and doing remixes and meeting with other producers and stuff. Are you still discovering new records kind of like 365 days a year?
Mm-hmm. Sure. I mean, electronic music is the output in electronic music is incredible. Like, I don't think there's any person on this planet who still has an overview on what's going on. The scene is completely fragmented, and there's like sub and sub sub and sub 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 genres of every genre. But it's an amazing playground if you lose your blinders and just dive into it.
Yeah.
You can just discover amazing things. As opposed to the early days when everything was focused on a few cities, the one I've mentioned before. Now it's a global phenomenon. There's amazing deep house music from India or whatever.
And how does that stuff get spread around? I mean, is the internet, the proliferation of digital music, is that what kind of makes it easy to send a file to someone, get the file sent back? Is that how work is done and how stuff is discovered these days? And I know you've come in to us in proper old school Monocle Weekly fashion with a big bag of records, Michael. Mm-hmm. there are two ways of doing it.
Yeah, I still like my records, but of course the internet changed the game completely. I think it's a great thing. I meet young artists, 18 years old guys, that know everything about Sun Ra and Philip Glass, and they're talking to me about this music like as if it would be the most normal thing that an 18 years old person knows all these things. But they got YouTube, they've got Wikipedia, they got all these sites and blogs, and it's a very precious thing that that we have here right now, like the accessibility of music. Of course, there's the turn side with drowning sales, but all in all, I would say for the culture of mankind, it's a gift that you can access culture that easily without having to pay.
I think that the internet should put that up as the kind of pull quote, the poster quote for the internet. It's important to the culture of all mankind. Mm. That's pretty good.
Yeah.
The internet has done well. what about the scene now in Cologne? And I wanted to ask you also about the scene in Berlin. People might not be familiar with the differences between the two. Maybe you could kind of tell us a little bit about how those two different cities rock.
Well, Berlin is the capital of Cologne's province.
Right. And does that bear itself out of that in the music? Is the music in Berlin a little bit more, is it a little bit more capitalist? And is the stuff in Cologne a little bit more wild?
Well, things changed a lot when Berlin became capital. Mm. Before that, Germany had a very diverse culture. Like every city had its own scene, its own sound. And when Berlin became capital, the wall came down. Most people moved to the capital because rents were cheap and there's a club on every corner. So for young aspiring artists, it's the perfect place to be. The sad side effect of it was that the subcultural climate in the rest of Germany was kind of dried out. And we're still dealing with the aftermath of that.
Yeah. And you should give us a track to play out on. What are you going to recommend for us? It's got to be one of your own.
A track from the album?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we could go with the first single. It's called Good Times.
Cool. Well, this is Michael Mayer's new track, Good Times.
That was Rob talking earlier to Michael Mayer of Compact Records, and you're listening to the Monocle Weekly.
Next week sees the London Film Festival taking over the city's cinemas. New work from filmmakers in locations ranging from Saudi Arabia to Senegal will be vying for the competition prize, a new element to the festival this year.
But does the London trophy cabinet glint alluringly like the silverware of Cannes or Venice? Earlier, Rob sat down with festival director Claire Stewart to find out.
Claire, thanks for joining us on The Weekly.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Now's not an unbusy time, I suppose, for the director of the London Film Festival. You kick off on Wednesday. That's when the red carpet gets scrubbed down and rolled out.
Two more days to go. I think they're scrubbing the red carpet already.
And this year, what people seem to be talking about in the run-up to the festival?
Well,
there's
a lot of excitement, a lot of buzz. I think one of the things that there seems to be quite a thrill around are our two big events that are going out across the UK for the first time. So we're taking opening night out to 30 screens across the UK simultaneously with a live cross to the red carpet, which is very exciting.
This is nice for everyone. Everyone gets, is inclusivity the word?
Inclusivity is absolutely
not with a capital
the word.
I, though, right?
And of course, we're doing the European premiere of Tim Burton's Frank and Weenie, with Tim on the carpet, as well as a number of the talented voice cast. So that's pretty exciting. And of course, also we're doing something quite similar with the world premiere of Crossfire Hurricane, which is
the Stones film.
Stones documentary commemorating their 50 years. It's kind of hard to imagine a 50-year career in rock and roll, but
it kind
that's
of is.
What
You're
got.
Saying that as well, as if you, by looking at them, you'd never know.
You wouldn't know. But this is a terrific film, and you know, it's directed by Brett Morgan, who did The Kid Stays in the Picture, and it just covers, I guess, a real focus on the first 20 years, but very playful and textured and great.
And this is cool, and it's pretty tough to make a Stones documentary. Many people have tried it, and many people have kind of been fobbed off, I think, in the process of trying to make a proper kind of warts and all kind of thing. There's lots of bits and pieces on the internet, aren't there, that people try to splice together to make a movie of. But this is quite a big deal, and it feels very London as well. There's lots of the films in the running and in the festival this year that seem to be quite London, quite British. It seems it's a good thing. There's Michael Haneke, there's Michel Ozon, François Ozon, should I say. But there's also a lot of London stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think some of the big premieres that we're doing in a gala context are very British indeed. Elia's autobiography, for example, which is, they play around with it. So I think I have license to say the dead python, Graham Chapman, and his actual voice reading of his autobiography by him, but animated by 14, 15 different animation companies. And that screening, that premiere at the Empire, is going to be really quite something. There's a lot of fun planned for the evening, and there'll be a couple of pythons on the carpet.
Did you imagine, hopefully it's sort of disrespectful in the right way, I suppose, throughout the movie?
Completely disrespectful. Very naughty indeed.
And I like the way you sort of even changed your demeanour to be kind of slightly strict and schoolmarmish there, Claire.
Well, you know, they also play around with the idea of censorship in the film, because of course he was such a provocateur that was very much a part of his, you know, his kind of daily life, if you like. But then there's also a couple of other really great British films that we're doing galas with as well. Song for Marion, which is, stars the great talent of Vanessa Redgrave and Terence Stamp. And it's kind of extraordinary to me. I actually had to do a bit of, like, you know, Little Miss IMDb.com and go, have they really never been in a film together before?
Right.
But they haven't. And this is a sort of really wonderful film where Vanessa Redgrave is actually sort of, you know, dying of cancer, but she's still full of life and participating in this choir that Gemma Arterton's character is the sort of choir teacher, and Terence Stamp is the sort of grumpy husband who doesn't want to join in, and it's really about the sort of, you know, transformation of his character, and those sparkling blue eyes are at you the whole time in this film. It's quite
wonderful.
You
feel pierced just sitting in the seat, don't you?
You do.
I wanted to ask you about a film, The Sapphires, which one of our correspondents told me about the other day, and we put it in the magazine, I think, in the upcoming magazine. This is the kind of film that is great for a festival, to be on a festival sort of roster, I guess, as well. This is an Aussie film about three Aborigine female singers that sort of make it big and become kind of like a bit like the Supremes or something.
Yeah, it's kind of like, as you can probably tell, culturally exciting for me to be presenting this film as my first year as director of the festival, you know, coming in from Australia. This film actually kind of embodies my cultural scenario, given that Chris O'Dowd...
They're going to put that on the poster.
It
embodies my cultural scenario.
Like the idea that Chris O'Dowd might just offer to be my personal manager. That'd be fantastic. Yeah. Anyway, he's obviously the hot kind of, you know, comic man of the moment, and just very, very funny, and literally is sort of, you know, stumbles across these girls in a pub scenario and decides to become their manager. It's set in the 60s. It's based on a true story. And it's at a time that was actually, you know, very politically difficult time for Aboriginals in Australia, in the sense that there was a definite issues around Stolen Generation and so forth. And the film is fabulous because it really touches on those political issues, but with such a light touch, and it's a real feel-good, kind of film. It was played a midnight screening at the Cannes Film Festival, which was where I saw it, and it had just a rousing, you know, standing ovation at the end of it. So
people don't get tired, even though the film finishes at 2 a.m. No. You still get your 10 minutes on your feet at the
end. Exactly.
And I wanted to, the festival's been switched up a little bit this year, there's a competition for the first time. There will be a best in show. And this sort of is similar to Venice and Toronto and Cannes.
Yeah.
This is why has it happened this year? A lot of people probably think, oh, the London Film Festival, you get to get their tickets, they go to see lots of great films before anybody else, and it's a nice thing. People might be surprised that this hadn't happened before. So why is it happening?
Well, in a way, we've made two quite significant changes to the programme, and this is one of them. So the awards themselves for Best Film and for Best Documentary and for Best First Feature Film have, you know, existed in the festival already. Mm. But the films that were competing for them were just kind of listed rather than presented in an official competition programme selection. And it just seemed to me that it was a lot more vivid and made it a lot more tangible for both audiences and for the positioning of the festival on the international stage to actually kind of pull out those films and position them in competitive sections. So, you know, we have great lineup in the official competition, for example, with new films by Sally Potter, by Michael Winterbottom, by Deepa Mehta. And we've also got some fantastic discoveries in the first feature competition that'll be competing for the Sutherland Award. And then the other big programming change that we made to the festival is that we've moved away from categorising films by geography, if you like, by where they come from. Mm-hmm. And now the program sections are designed under headings like Dare and Thrill and Love and Laugh, you know. And I think the film festival has really benefited from that there's a sense of anticipation of just kind of keeping that festival vibe going,
keeping the energy in the room. For the time being, Claire Stewart, head honcho of the London Film Festival, thank you so much for joining us. And I hope on the red carpet it's a heels year rather than a wellies year this year.
Thank you, so do I.
That was Rob Bound talking to Claire Stewart, and you're listening to the Monocle Weekly.
We're often spinning the globe here at Monocle and jetting to visit the people and places that make the world turn. But closer to home is Peter Bellaby, a man whose business is to design and create globes themselves. The spinning kind in the corner of a study, that is. At the moment, the kind Google don't own. He's been the subject of a new exhibition at the Royal Geographical Society, and Monocle's Chris Fitch went there to try and become a little more worldly.
Peter Bellaby is owner and chief globe maker at Bellaby & Co., and also curator of the latest exhibition showing off the result of their endeavours at the Royal Geographical Society in London, entitled
Geographic Blueprint, the Art of the Handcraft Globe. We're a small globe maker who make everything in the traditional way by hand. I think that the main thing about a globe is it is the only fully accurate map that is out there. Every other flat map is a projection, which is wonderful, and they look amazing. But a globe allows you to see everything exactly correctly with distances between places. For instance, when you're going on a flight and you're wondering why you're going from Europe to North America and you're going over the poles, when you see a globe, it puts it into perspective, because that can be a quicker route, certainly from one side of the planet to another. In the Northern Hemisphere, it's obviously quicker going over the poles, but you can't see that on a flat map. I think globes will always be relevant. They will always hark back to the olden days, perhaps, but certainly with our new way of making globes where they revolve on roller bearings, we're trying to force them into the 21st century.
Okay, so tell us a bit more about your globes. What kinds of things can people get from you?
We initially started by just effectively copying the traditional style, using plaster of Paris, having brass meridians, having intricately crafted oak stands. Since then, we've launched three different globes, ranging from the mini desk globe at 23 centimetres diameter, going up to the 50-inch Churchill. All of these sit on very interesting roller bearings, which is a bearing sitting on lots of more bearings, which allow our bearing, the globe, to move freely in any direction.
You've got the globes, which do essentially act like a map. It's a contemporary view of the physical and political world. But you've also got lots of artistic globes. So where does a globe stand for you between being a piece of art and an accurate educational tool?
I think it's both at the same time. I think the large globes we make are stunning works of art. I have one customer who's had a room built and it will be pride of place in that room alongside some very contemporary paintings in the other end of the room. And it's kind of a, I think you need to be inspired, and there's been a lack of inspiration in globe making for many decades, if not centuries, because the whole way of printing became more mechanized and all colors were able to be printed. Globe making lost its beauty. It became more accessible to everyone, which is fantastic, but it also meant that the upper end sort of died a death because the competition was much more modern and much easier and cheaper to produce.
And what do you gain from the fact that your globes are handcrafted as opposed to mass-produced, machine-crafted?
Accuracy, I would say. Everything that is in on the map that we print out and painstakingly cut by hand ends up on the globe. But also the fact that everyone is made with love. It takes a long time. It takes weeks to make a Churchill globe. It takes days to make the regular floor-standing globes. There's a lot of love and care, and every single one is unique. No one will ever have a globe that looks the same as any other one that we make. They're all different. I think people want to have that and want to pay for that. I think it's important in the world we're kind of in at the moment. People are wanting more celebrated products, products that are more individual. People are suddenly deciding that they're finding value in products that are handmade, that mean something, not just mass product that we've, I guess, perhaps got used to being shipped from China for the last 10 years, and it has its place, but it's, I think, something that's beautiful like this equally has its place.
The exhibition perfectly displays how Peter's redesigned 360-degree contemporary globes reflect those perspectives of their owners. People who like to spin, flip, and ultimately look at the world from a completely different point of view. To reignite a craft which many would have thought resigned to history.
Trying to change the way the globe-making world is perceived, which I can imagine many people would look at it and feel it's quite a stuffy old craft. Well, we're using Aston Martin to make our bases, and we're using the latest materials in the globe. We use Formula One pattern makers to make the perfect spheres, which are made out of GRP. So it's anything but old and fuddy-duddy. Whilst we've taken our inspiration from the past, we're very much forward-thinking and want to create modern globes that are really very interactive. The thing about these is they're wonderful. You can go up to them, you can spin them around in any direction, and they become like the ultimate executive toy, because this is a globe you can de-stress and plan your next holiday at the same time.
For Monocle, I'm Christopher Fitch.
And that's just about all we've got time for this Sunday, Andrew. You're off for your roast.
I am kind of off my roast. I'm off to Berlin tomorrow.
Oh, are you? Nice.
A one-day trip.
Oh, is that a good... Is that... You've kind of got a... It was a bit of a... Wait.
Yeah, because I see that the car is booked to pick me up at 4 o'clock in the morning.
God.
Which is when you know your week starts with a 4 o'clock car.
Yeah, it can only get better, right?
It can only... No, it's exciting.
Just imagine the heady heights of Wednesday lunch. You might have the most amazing, beautiful lunch in somewhere.
I can hang out for the day with Kimberly Bradley for Monocle 24. We've got quite an exciting thing coming up for The Urbanist, our Berlin correspondent. So that's me for the week. And you?
That's nice. I've got freeze. So my Monday is going to be sort of the hot compress on the head. I'm going to be taking all my paracetamol and headache pills in advance, so that on Tuesday when we let rip, I feel all right. But actually, it's a big week. It's going to be a good week for the culture show as well. We're doing two live shows from Frieze, actually, from within the tent. I think the only people ever to have done that. So fingers crossed that works out, and it's not a false promise, but yeah.
Well, let's hope they don't make them do... You don't have to do them too early in the morning, because I know that there's quite a few late nights involved in covering.
Yeah, no, I think these are going to be... I think they're going to be sort of Midori House style programmes, a bit like the Olympic ones.
Good.
We did.
Well, make sure I'm on your ticket a couple of times, because
you should.
I like Frieze.
This is the time when you and I kind of go out and paint the town a sort of a damask.
Yes.
It's a more grown-up version of red, because we're both, you know... It's not 5 years ago anymore, Andrew. But I was still trying to pretend it is.
Okay, me too.
So that'll be a fun Frieze week. And then at the end of the week, as we spoke to Claire Stewart earlier on in the show, is a bit of London Film Festival, so we can sort of recover in a nice sort of well-upholstered London cinema seat and watch something kind of tidy on screen.
And maybe even have a look at Quartz find out what's happening in the world of business. That
would, yeah, exactly.
That was a good chat with Justin B. Smith.
Justin B. Smith was very good, actually. He's one of those people who kind of feel like we could dedicate a bit of a show to him, actually, to kind of like, how's this work then?
I've got a feeling he's a man that never has a lazy afternoon either. He's going places.
I think he is. And he's got a kind of quite a good glint in his eye. You feel like he probably does go around and sort of fix things and probably knows everyone by name and does all that kind of stuff that you're meant to do. Like you, Andrew.
Yeah, a bit like me.
Hey. So Claire Stewart was good. The London Film Festival, we're looking forward to that. What about the Globes thing? Do you like Globes?
I do like Globes, actually. In fact, our editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé.
Well, I've got the giggles. I don't know.
Because you're thinking I mean something rude and trouser-related.
Trouser-related.
Or below the waist, but I'm not. I mean that I actually like Globes. Our editor-in-chief has quite a collection.
Yeah, he does actually.
Not ancient ones, but kind of like 60s hip.
Snow globes. If it's got a decorative bridge in it.
Don't start rumours, Robert Bound. I think we should leave it there.
Thank you very much, Tom Hall, for producing today's show, and Jack Phillips for engineering. Alex Funnell, I think, also helped out, didn't he? Lots of people seemed to run in and out of behind the glass, didn't they, today?
Nobody could be bothered to stay for the whole show.
It's only us, the stalwarts.
And the listeners, I hope.
That was episode 170. We should say goodbye from me, Robert Bound.
And me, Andrew Tuck.
Thanks for tuning in.